IsraelScene.com.
Yes, you're listening to IsraelScene.com, and I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram, and we're going to have more Alexenberg. Yes, can't get enough. Steve, did you notice that some of the ideas that Menachem presents are the same as those that Miriam talked about in her program on Semitism? And I think that's really one of the inspirations or purposes of this series, is to sort of mix up and see how these ideas, the continuity of ideas and the similarity of the ideas, even though they come to us in a different accent and sometimes from different directions, which seems to indicate that they have some kind of a real basis. And now Menachem will continue on this interview from Jerusalem.
And so it generates real charity for helping, you know, blind. It gives opportunity for blind people to see the images they like to see. It gives this whole world community opportunity to participate in this. So, I mean, this is kind of open system art that's, you know, goes back to my days as a biologist where I worked with ecological systems. I mean, this is art of ecological systems.
How does Judaism and the digital age combine? It seems to me lehefech, that the digital systems are very squared. I think when I hear the word digital, I think in terms of square, rectangle, triangle. I mean, rigid kind of forms. Or is that my mistake? Is there something more expansive?
I think it could be. I mean, but I think that maybe we're even in the post-digital age now. I think that, you know, there's this folk song about John Henry who competed with the first steam engine that could lay track, and he had a competition with it, and he tied with it and died. Right. The beginning of the industrial age, and I think that Barry Kasparov, the chess expert, and actually is an Israeli-made computer program that beat him in chess. That he couldn't beat the computer anymore. So for right-brain thinking, right hemispheric thinking, the computers are better than we are. Just like, and I think that what we have is the agricultural age was an extension of our muscular system. You had an ox that made your arm stronger. You had a horse that made your legs faster. The Industrial Revolution was just a change in quantity, in kind. It wasn't a change in kind. It was a quantitative change, not a qualitative change. So that instead of an ox, you had a tractor, and instead of a horse, you had a car. You know, in other words, you still was an extension of the muscular system. But in the information age, the digital age, we're talking about extension of the central nervous system. We're talking about computers, which are extension of brain, primarily the left hemisphere of the brain, and an extension of our central nervous system, where you can talk to people all over the world. This summer, my wife and I went on vacation to Switzerland, and we were standing on the top of the highest mountain, on the snow in the summer, on the top of the highest mountain in Switzerland. And my son was in a summer course in Beijing, in China. And, you know, I call him on Cellcom, an Israeli cell phone, and I don't have to dial his number. It's just the same number that I call his cell phone from my cell phone from the top of the Alps to Beijing in China, you know, and through an Israeli satellite, you know. And, I mean, that the whole world gets interconnected in this digital age. And so you have this extension of the central nervous system, of the brain system. But I think it extended the left hemisphere of the brain, the analytic, and it does it. I mean, it can calculate much better than we can. It can store information, retrieve information. But the kind of left right hemisphere kind of functioning of a kind of creative synthesis and stuff is what we're. So that I think that there's a post digital age in the sense that. That we need to that deals with search for spiritual meaning, creative encounter with the the world, human relations, interpersonal. This is not stuff that digital thing happened. And I think that there's often a counter. There's a counter trend. John Nesbitt wrote a book, High Tech, High Touch, and he said his thesis is that whenever there's more high tech, there's a demand for more high touch. Also, in other words, corresponding, so that when they introduce computer graphics courses into art departments of universities or art schools, they had more courses in ceramics. You know, in other words, there's a need for this counterbalance experience. And that's why I'm interested, like the cyber site thing. I'm interested in how changes in cyberspace affect changes in real space. How people, and I'm interested in the interplay between the digital world and the real world, cyberspace and real space, and this dialogue between them and this kind of interaction, you know, between these two worlds. And I think that the digital age provides this kind of open-ended kind of anybody who plays on with the internet knows how all of a sudden you have a world that opened up to such extent that it's just mind-boggling that you have, you know, access to information that, you know, you'd have to spend, you know, months and months at Columbia University's library to try to find out what takes two clicks on the internet now, you know, and the access to information. Now, the question is, how do you take all this stuff and how do you create new combinations? What's the collage of these things, you know? How do you put all these things together to have new meaning and things like that, and a kind of, you know, looking at these. And I have a new blog, you know, that's an interesting blog. It's www.photographgod.com. Yes, that's a project I've been doing with my students this year, and they have to photograph God. That's what their job is. And how do you photograph God, you know? Well, I think, first of all, to a Jew, God is a verb. The yud and the hey and the vav and hey is hayah, hoveh, v'yeh, is was, is, will be. Actually, God's not an appropriate word. God is, you know, is a Germanic word that means some kind of superpower that saps people who are not good from some outside sky or something like that. Judaism is not about that. Judaism is not about. In reality, there is no God in Judaism. Reality is God. You see, David Aaron wrote this book, Seeing God, and Rabbi in the Old City, and he says, you know, in reality, there is no God. God is reality, and in order to see God, you got to look at reality, you know, And like Rav Soloveitchik says, where is the Kedusha? It's in a bust. It's any place you want to look. If you open your eyes to look at it. The Rebbe Lubavitch told me once that the word for material and spiritual is the same word backwards. That the word in Hebrew, chomer, and ruach being spiritual, and chomer, both start with resh and chet. There are four letters that are interchangeable in Hebrew grammar. Bumaf, letters that you say with your lips. And so Vav and Mem are interchangeable letters. So Chomer and Ruach is the same word backwards. And so Rebbe said, what's the difference between the Olam Chomri v'Ruchani, the spirit, material and spiritual world? It's your perspective. If you, you know, Zavitria, if you look at the world like this and you see a material world, it'll be a material world. But if you make a switch in your head and change your perspective, then that same material world becomes a spiritual one. And the Judaism is that idea, to make a switch in your head, to take reality and make it spiritual. It's not escaping from the material world to some other realm of spirituality. Spirituality is the quality of your encounter with the material world. And I remember I was at a conference with Rabbi Steinsaltz, Adin Steinsaltz, shortly after I had this talk with the Rebbe. And I told him what the Rebbe said to me. And he said to me, do you know that the statement in English of the ultimate Gashmiut, the ultimate crass materiality, is wine, women, and song. I mean, there's an expression in English, wine, women, and song. That's the ultimate materialism, right? And he said, in Judaism, we say kiddush on wine, kiddushin on women, and according to tradition, the Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is Kodesh Kodeshim. And so in Judaism, the Holy of Holies is wine, women, and song. We say the blessing on wine is kiddush. Marriage is called kiddushin. And Shir HaShirim is considered the holiest book of the Bible, the Song of Songs. So wine, women, and song. So that's Judaism. It's to take the most materialist thing that can possibly be. And wine, women, and song can be very material. That's like you said, the digital age. Digital can be very left-brain and take you away from it. But on the other hand, that very same thing can be transformed into the height of spirituality, you see. And I think I teach my students if you're going to photograph God, what's definition? What are you talking about? And, well, we know God's here in reality, but what aspects you should be looking for? But in the Bible, it says, you know, Lecha Hashem, Hagadula, Hagvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Chod, V'chol B'Shamayim V'aretz. You know, you, God, you know, are largesse or compassion, chesed, strength, beauty, eternity, splendor, and foundation. That's the sfirot, from Divrei Hayamim, from the Chronicles. And it's in the tefillah. In the morning we say that, and it's when we take we sing it when we take the Torah out of the ark, you know, Lecha Hashem Hagadula Hagvura Tiferet. So here's the definition of God. You, God, are these things. Compassion, and, you know. So they have to find these sfirot in their everyday life and photograph them. They have to photograph compassion and strength and beauty and what these different words are these aspects of the divine in our everyday world, in their everyday world. But they have to do it in a dynamic way. Judaism is not to make a dynamic world static. That's idolatry. Because I always love, on the back of a mezuzah, mezuzah means, zaz means movement. But on the back of the mezuzah is written kuzu. You know, every mezuzah, and most people don't know it. When I ask my class, I can have a class like in Ariel of 100 students. I teach 100 students in every class. And I ask them about kuzu. And it's very rare that any one student even knows about kuzu. But it's written on the back of every mezuzah. It says kuzu. Chaf, vav, zayin, vav. What's kuzu? Upside down, and you know. But if you look through the mezuzah and see where it's written every time it says the yud, hey, and the vav hei. On the other side of yud hei vav kei, on the other side of the scroll, is written kuzu. What's kuzu? Kuzu's God in motion. It's the letter after each of the letters. Instead of yud, they write chaf, the next letter in the Hebrew alphabet. Instead of hei, it's vav. Instead of vav, it's zayin. And hey, so kuzu is Hashem b'tenuah, God in motion. You see, and not only that, it's upside down. It's seeing it from every possible angle. So God can't ever. God is a verb, like Rav Cooper's book. You know, God, but God is in motion. You know, and it's was, is, will be. It's tenuah. It's kuzu. Kuzu is the word for God on the back of the mezuzah, and so they can't photograph Tiferet, you know, or beauty, or hod. They have to see it, they have to have it becoming. They have to show the process. So they have to have a series of photographs to show how compassion is realized, how these things happen in an event. You know, so that's the process. So I got some wonderful, wonderful things that I actually then put up a website. Everybody can look at it, www.photographgod.com. And I showed some of the student work, and I invite everybody in the world to contribute their pictures of God. You know, everybody can photograph it, because God is everywhere if you open your eyes and see this dynamic character of vital reality. You know,
it's interesting you say kuzu, and the thing that comes to mind there is a grass.
that grows in the southeast United States called kudzu grass. I think that's how it's called, sort of how it's spelled. And it's a grass that you can't stop. Once you plant it, it just grows. It's like an endless growing grass. And I think it's like all one plant, or it's one root, and it just keeps, you know, going underground and coming up and going underground and coming up. And once you plant that, you can't plant anything else. It's encompassing. Let's try something else here. Israel, you've chosen to do this work of yours here. And how does Israel, the word, the concept, the reality, fit into this this future art? Or does it?
I think postmodernism is multiple identities and multiple worlds. My book is about multiple fields. It's about the relationship of art, science, technology, and culture. So I have multiple identities, that I'm a Jew, I'm an Israeli, I'm a third-generation American. I am all of these things, and the dialogue between them, or the dynamic between them, is invigorating. And I have different roles. I'm an artist, I'm a teacher, I'm a researcher. I mean, people have multiple, and I'm a father, you know, and a grandfather, and a great-grandfather. And I have, you know, so I have all these different roles, you know, and so I think that, but being in Israel my book proposes that the root of Western civilization's change is its shift from the Hellenism to Judaism. What's strange about being in Israel, in a way, the art scene in Israel doesn't understand that at all. In fact, more is happening in that direction in America than in Israel. And in America, I played the art game in the broad sense of that word. I mean, I was a professor of art at Columbia University. I was the head of the art department at Pratt Institute, America's largest and oldest and most prestigious art school. You know, I was a number of years at the Center for Advanced Visual Studies at MIT. So I played the game, and I have my artwork in more than 40 museums, not Jewish museums, you know, that deal with digital technologies and spirituality and global systems. And so I have, but I think that what explains the importance of that in terms of contemporary art is a book by Thomas Friedman that called The Lexus and the Olive Tree. Its subtitle is Understanding Globalization. And I think, on the one hand, I'm talking about globalization. I'm talking about an internet that's worldwide. I'm talking about multiple identities. I'm talking about living in America and living in Israel and being both, and you know, and being Jewish. And on the other hand, functioning in the leading edge of all the world art. I'm not, you know, in the parochialism of being either Israeli or Jewish alone. But his thesis in his book, wonderful book, is that without roots, you're going to be blown over by globalization. The one who succeeds in playing the globalization game is the one who has roots. And I think that a lot of Jews in America and in Israel have become rootless. They're not rooted in their Jewish roots, and they think that they're cosmopolitan and worldly and so on. But the only way to his the title of his book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree. Well, the olive tree is Israel, you know, and it's in its roots. And the Lexus, he says, he writes about going to Toyota City and to see the Lexus factory, where they put out 300 luxury cars a day. And how many people work in the Lexus factory? 60 people put out 300 cars a day. And none of the 60 ever touches anything in the car. The 60 work in quality control, make sure the robots are doing their job 24 hours a day. You know, it's all done by robots. Nobody touches a Lexus, you know, or a Toyota. I mean, then Toyota owns 200 sub-companies. They own rubber companies in Malaysia. They own the suppliers that they need. So it's a global product that comes all together. You know, and so you have globalization, But the Japanese are rooted in their own culture. They know who they are and where they are and their history, and they're not blown away and threatened by this global game. It's exciting. But when you have to play the global game, when you have no roots, then it's scary. And that's a lot of the demonstrations against globalization are rootless people. Because people would, now, roots alone will give you poverty. Roots alone will give you what's happening in Gaza Strip or something like that, where there isn't any Lexus, where they can't build a Lexus. They don't know how to do that. And if you can't build a Lexus, what we need to do here is be able to build a Lexus and be with our roots, you know. But either way, just building Lexus, you know, or just having roots won't work in the contemporary world.
Do you have a take on the word skula?
Oh, yes. Yeah. In fact, I just dealt with, today I talked about my class, you know, the Jews are am skula, you know.
Purple
people, exactly. I think, and there's a wonderful because Segula, which is translated chosen people, but it's really Segol is purple, the color purple. Purple people, certainly. So we're the purple people. Now, what's purple? Well, if you mix paints together, you know that to get purple, you mix blue and red. You see, the blue of the sky, and the red, the Adom of Adama, the red of the earth. And the job, what does that mean for the Jew? The Jew's job then is to mix blue and red, to bring this blue of the sky into the earth, to humanity, because Adam, red, is earth, Adama, and Adam, man. And you have to bring the tchelet of the Shamayim of the heaven into the everyday life of, then you mix them together, you become purple people. That's our job. That's what we're chosen to do.
Do you have any idea how it became such a narrow concept of... it seems to be a very chauvinistic concept.
Well, I think it's a mistranslation or a misunderstanding. I mean, you know, someone who understands Hebrew knows it's purple. You know, if you don't translate it, and they translate it in the King James Bible as chosen people, you know, but maybe it doesn't say, you know, what that means. But that's what we're chosen for. We're supposed to do that. If we can't do that, we're not doing our job. We have to show how you can bring the blue into the red. How do you bring the sky into the earth and into humanity? How into the everyday world? Mix them together, and that makes purple.
Which is also, some people think part of the Magen David is the triangle coming from heaven.
Right.
Intermixing.
Certainly.
The triangle.
Right, right. Yeah, it's, you know, Jacob's ladder, where the angels ascend and descend, you know, and come down. And in my book, I deal with computer angels. Because in the Torah itself, the word art, oman, doesn't appear. That appears in Psalms and Tehillim and stuff like that. But in the Torah itself, the word is Malechet Machshevet. You know, Malechet Machshevet. Thoughtful craft. It's two words, Malechet Machshevet. That's the word for art in the Torah. And it says Bezalel, the prototypic, you're talking about Jewish artists, the prototypic Jewish artist, Bezalel, it says Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur. Bezalel literally means in the shadow of God, in God's shadow. Why isn't his name Bor El? Why isn't it in God's light? Why in shadow? Well, because the creative process has its negative side. You can use creativity for evil also. And the Freudian underpinnings of creative process and stuff like that. So you got to work in that understanding, you know, that you have to transform your creative urges to tikkun olam, not destroying the world, you see, because the same creative energies can be used to destroy the world. So that, but then it says his name is Ben Uri Ben Hur, the son of flaming light, the son of freedom. What a name for an artist, you know, freedom and flaming passion, you know, in the divine shadow that he said, you know, and in fact, that all of the Kabbalah comes from that same sentence. It says that he had Ruach Hashem, Chochmah, Bina, V'dat. Those are the three highest sfirot. The other ones we already mentioned. The Chesed Gudula, that's from Divrei Yamim, it's not from the Torah. The only Sfirot in the Torah are in the two times it describes the artist, you see. And so that the Kabbalah, and if you read Kabbalah, I mean, the word Kabbalah itself comes in the Torah, the Kuf Bet Resh is not Lekabel. Although I like to receive, I like, in Hebrew, I hear the word Kabbalah in Israel all the time. Kabbalah is what you get at the supermarket printout. And I like the barcode. It's like talus stripes, but it's the secret code, the secret language of the digital age, right? The supermarket laser can read it, and we're illiterate. We're illiterate in the secret language that only robotic supermarket lasers read, and it tells you the product, you know.